delighted to have Jackson Burnside III this evening to talk about why he chose these pieces of art for this exhibition. And for those of you who did not attend the opening event, this is the first time we've had a guest curator, and we were so delighted when Jackson accepted. And also it was very, very meaningful to have Jackson be our first guest curator. He was a great friend of Vincent's. He's part of the family, and he was also very instrumental in us actually setting up this foundation with all his advice and encouragement. So without further ado, Jackson Burnside, the stage is yours.
Thank you, thank you. I wondered who she was talking about, but anyhow. Well, I've been thinking about what we really should be talking about tonight, right? And I have to tell you, this was quite a challenge to pick this group of paintings to represent the Viagra Foundation. There are about 800 paintings altogether that Vincent has amassed over a very, very short period of time. Saskia says, part of the family because I ended up marrying Marina's first cousin. And the first cousin who was born on Vincent's birthday, right when they had just gotten engaged to be married or something of the other. So, of course, he had to investigate what were my credentials and who was I coming in the family and so on and so forth. So that started a relationship that went on until he passed. Vincent, at that time, was not interested in Bohemian art, really. He was collecting. He was collecting a lot of different things. Particularly, he was collecting Audubon paintings of birds. He was collecting Asian antiques. He had quite a few really special pieces of Asian furniture, Chinese furniture. And he had a kind of soft interest in the things that were about art. He knew that sooner or later Dane and Denisio would be getting out of school and he wouldn't have those bills anymore, and so he could turn his attention to spending his money on some of the things that he would really, really enjoy. Unlike so many men of his stature who are so successful in business, Vincent's sweetheart was his art collection. And he poured a lot into his sweetheart. And what you see here is really a representation of a real love affair that Vincent had with his work. He would come by our house and he wanted to know what was it about particular artists. He was particularly interested at one point in Amos Ferguson. And he came and he said, well, you know, what's with this Amos Ferguson and why you collect his work? And he tried to explain that Amos was an intuitive. Well, we had to discuss that word just to begin with. And that Amos painted from his heart and he painted from his feeling and from his intuition and he painted the stories that he knew. Stories that he grew up with, the stories that he learned from folks in the community that he grew up in the Exumas, and when he came here, and then when he went on the projects, all of these stories came into his work, and he began to really to express that story that resonated with a whole lot of other Bohemians. And for that reason, we felt he was important. And so many Bohemians would say, well, but he can't draw, but my children can draw like it. And we would say, well, you know, you really got a challenge. My brother and myself, at that point, Stan had come back to the Bahamas. This is in the early 80s, and Vincent's just really beginning to collect work. And at first, he collected work that was subjective, and he had to be able to see an image and see character in it, but he always collected what he loved. And eventually, as he learned more, as he got to know about people like Amos Ferguson, I particularly singled him out at the beginning because there were two occasions that I can remember with Amos. One was at the High Museum in Atlanta. There was a show, Ancestral Legacy. The I don't remember if it said the heritage of Africa in the diaspora, but really talking about the influence of African art and African traditions on this side of the world. And headlining that show on the collaterals, on the brochure, was Amos Ferguson. And then Forbes magazine did a story on the best and biggest, I don't remember exactly how they headlined it, but the best and biggest corporate collections in America. And the very first piece in that article was an image of Amos Ferguson's work. And when Vincent saw that, he got really, really excited. And he realized that this show, because I think it happened around the same time. My memory, you know, I'm not exactly sure the dates, but he found a way. I remember him coming to my house and brought the catalog for the show at the High Museum. And I said, well, how did you get this? You know, did you order this? This is before Amazon. I said, how'd you get it? He said, well, you know, Marina and I went, and we saw the show, and it's a really good show. I said, well, you really serious? So we packed up shortly afterwards, and we went and we went to see the show. I think it was about two. I don't remember what it was. But she recognized Amos. She's born on Amos's birthday, so I had to mention that. And so this whole thing starts to intertwine. So here's the conversation about Amos going on. So he begins to realize that there's some validity in Amos's taking the license that he took, the freedom that he took, the just trusting his own intuition and being able to do what he did, and that was a very important part of what he did. Now, around the same time, I would guess, or maybe shortly afterwards, someone similar was Wellington Bridgewater, who also was an intuitive, who also was drawing on the stories that he grew up with, drawing on the stories of the Bible, which is very, very important to both Amos and to him, because, you know, for somebody who grew up, if you grew up in the Family Islands and you weren't formally educated, and I say in quotes, you ended up getting your stories from the preacher, and the preacher's stories went into your work, and that's what you painted, and that's what Amos painted. But Amos stimulated a lot of Bohemian artists, including myself, and I'm sure many of the artists who are in this collection, because he was bold enough and he was courageous enough to say, I paint not by sight, but by faith, or the other way around. I think by faith and not by sight. But he recognized that within him was this power to paint something that was very special. And then Vincent then went on this journey, studying and really researching and finding out about art. Now around the same time, of course, you had a Max Taylor going to New York, going to Europe and paying attention to the masters and paying attention to their draftsmanship and the way they drew and bringing these traditions back to the Bahamas and influencing a lot of us. Kendall Hanna went to New York at a time when New York was really just flourishing and the New York really becomes the center of art in the 20th century. Before that it was Paris, and New York becomes big, and Kendall is in the midst of that, and de Kooning and Jackson Pollock and so many other, the abstract expressionists are working, and Kendall got really caught in that, and you know, Kendall no longer could just paint the subjective. And you know, you begin to see that in Kendall's work. So what I find each time I come into this room, and this wasn't all deliberate. A lot of what I pulled here was based on what felt good. Saskia gave me on, I guess it was a PDF of the collection of the works. I went through a couple of times, and then they came down, and we sat down, and we talked, and we went back and forth, and with this work, with that work, and you know, where was the connection? What was it that we were working with? And then you know, it dawned on us that what Vincent had was an eye for the work that set him apart, that was so distinctive that he could walk into an artist studio and he would never immediately buy it. He wanted to know. He wanted to question. He wanted to hear from the artist. If there was one painting in here that you wouldn't sell, what was that painting? And when he understood which painting it was, he said, "That's the painting I want." Particularly if you said no. I can share that now that Vincent's not around, because you know, a lot of the artists can use that to get a lot of work sold. No. No, but seriously, it mattered to Vincent. It mattered to Vincent that he bought the one you love. You know, I mean, it was like a love affair. I mean, that's what it was. He would come in and he would study the work and he would really contemplate the work. So he would go to Kendall and he would sit for hours with Kendall and have conversations with Kendall and try to understand what was it about Kendall's work that made Kendall feel his work was special. And what were the pieces of Kendall's work that Kendall didn't want to part with, and then he would work on that, and then you can you know speak to any of the artists. Toby Lund is here, and he's in the show, and Antonius is also in the show, and they can both tell you that's the way Vincent worked. That he would come and he would really study. I'm going to just jump around because I think there's a thread that ties all of these together. There's age. There is the fact that Amos Ferguson, Wellington Bridgewater, Kendall Hannah, Max Taylor are amongst the oldest of the persons represented here. I believe that's correct. Then, of course, there's Brent Ballone and then Ralph Harris. And then my brother and myself, you know, that happened so quickly. You know, I didn't think I was that far up in that list in terms of age. But the reality is that these artists were all in beginning to influence each other. We were all beginning to influence each other, and Vincent found himself in the midst of all this activity. And by the 1990s, Vincent had very little of this collection. But between the 1990s and today, he collected 800 works. I mean, that's a tremendous achievement. And he, I believe, was inspired by a vision that said that he understood and realized that he was building. I like the word foundation. He was building the foundation, not that he expressed it that way, but he knew that he was laying down the foundation for the construction of something extremely important for the development of our country. Not so much the collection of art, but an influence of our thinking and our ability to be able to express ourselves and to make a mark on an identity that was to emerge out of independence and would lead us into the 21st century. And I think that was extremely important. And you begin to see that. You begin to see that as you move through the room. We deliberately did not put these works in chronological order, but if you move around the room, if you look at those persons born after 1973, and you look at those persons born before 1973, with the exception of Kendall and in this case Marx, although Marx's reference to the subject matter kind of gives him away as somebody who is a part of that earlier period, you begin to see the difference that those of us born before.
Oh, sorry, that's not me. Pardon me.
Well, the preacher says, I hope that's God, because no one else should interrupt me. Anyhow, I brought that on your priest. So, When you look at the works that were done before 73, you talk about Marx and Marx's travels to Europe, and what really hit Marx is, Marx was very influenced by the Cubists and by Picasso and Brancusi and Braque and Modigliani and these persons who had been heavily influenced by the art of Africa that was coming into Europe, that was beginning to influence the way European art was being expressed, that the abstraction of the form, as it happened in African sculpture, was beginning to represent itself in the works of the European arts. I'm going to put this somewhere out of my hand before I spill it. So Marx was being heavily influenced by this, and as he saw it, Kendall Hanau, of course, went to New York at a time when New York had something very, very special. He came after what they call the Harlem Renaissance, but he was there. In New York, and being influenced by a lot of the African American artists, who, if the truth be told, people like Charles White and Romare Bearden were leading that influence of the African art in New York, in America. I mean, they were leading the charge, and Kendall and Marx got influenced by that, and they came back, and they influenced any number of us. Brent Vallone, on the other hand, went to Europe and studied in England, and he got exposed to those persons who were painting the ordinary people of their communities, and he began to pay attention to the ordinary people of our communities. And I think what we all began to understand is that we didn't have to go to some other place to find some peasant culture that was expressing itself with such rich energy that you could come to Grantstown and Bainetown and paint the architecture and the people of Grantstown and Bainetown. And you began to see that, not only in Max Taylor's work, but you began to see it emerging in Brent's work. And then Brent, of course, exploded when he took on Junkanoo. And he took on Junkanoo at a time when the majority of the people of the Bahamas, including the black folks, felt that Junkanoo was not for them. If you were going to get an education, because people didn't do that. You didn't show up in Junkanoo. You certainly didn't celebrate it the way he did. And he caused there to be a lot of attention to be given to the art and the design and the color systems of Junkanoo. People like Tony McKay and of course Blind Blake and Freddie Munnings in the music were celebrating the obvious. I mean, they were celebrating the Junkanoo sound. But Max Taylor, Brent Vallone, Homer Williams, can't leave him out. A man by the name of Sterling Miller. They were all beginning to touch the Junkanoo, but Brent took it and in many ways made it his own. And you began to see that come out in his work. And of course, Ralph Harris also did. He painted quite a bit of John Canoe, and I think in the Diaghilev, there are at least two in this in the Foundation collection. There are at least two Ralph Harris's. And what's important about that, I believe, is when that's when the cultures, I believe, of our Bahamas that have been so divided by this very hard line of Collins Wall, metaphorically and physically separated by this Collins Wall, began to come together. That there was this level of appreciation that was happening, and the artists began to paint our fishermen and paint our musicians and paint the ladies in the market, and it became an important part of what we were doing. But it was all still very subjective. And then along comes my brother Stan, who every time he produces his work, it becomes different. But then he became a teacher at the College of the Bahamas, and he had at one point he had a really wonderful class, Erica James and John Beadle and Eric Ellis and Clive Stewart and Toby Lunn. They were all students of Stan's at some point, and there were others who he influenced. But I particularly call them out. John Beadle's work is here. Eric Ellis is here. Clive Stewart back there, and of course Toby Lunn produced the Emperor, which is at the back. There's a special story about the Emperor for Vincent. That I only really just learned. I knew that Vincent always liked the painting. Vincent would go to an art show, and oftentimes when I arrived, he'd say, "Well, what do you think?" And then I would find out that he has already made his decisions, and he's bought what he's gonna buy anyhow. So, you know, the hell with what I thought. But I think he trusted my judgment. It got to the point where he was so good at and his confidence at collecting the work became so strong that he knew where the best works were. And I remember walking into a show, Jessica Colebrook's work. There's a piece at the that I put in the collection that. I walked in the show, and I walked around the show. I saw Vincent in the distance, so I made a kind of very quick move around the space, and then I went to Vincent and I said, "That piece, you bought it." And he said, yeah, how do you know? Well, I mean, that's just the way it was. Vincent would find the most unusual, the most coveted work of the artist, and that was what he wanted, because he knew that it represented the artist's stretch beyond the envelope. That the artist had jumped off the wall, flying down the side of the mountain without any confidence from anybody else. And sometimes the artist was quite nervous about this jump. And a lot of this jump was happening after the 1990s. Going to the year 2000, it's a particular story that I'll share with you of Toby Lunn when Toby broke barracks and started to be the non-figurative expressionist that he has become, and he's consistently painted that way since. But he felt it in his gut that he needed to be painting that way, and he showed at the College of Bahamas, I believe it was the last show at the College of Bahamas, and he showed this work, and Vincent walks into that show, The Color of Harmony. He walks into the show and he walks around and he says, "I really like that work." And his buying that work is what I believe, and Toby, you know, we can talk about that as part of this conversation, is what launched Toby into saying, "Well, I have the nerve, I have the Doc, I need some technical terms. I don't want to use that word in front of these ladies. But I have the
in Spanish.
The technical. Yeah, there's some seats up front here, if anybody.
Yes, please come and sit for those of you who are standing who want to sit.
This is a technical equipment.
Anyhow, I have a friend in Japan who says equipment. But he had the nerve and the guts to say, well, this is the direction I'm going to go in. At a time when really only Kendall Hannah and an emerging Antonius Roberts was beginning to look at expressionist work. Dr. Erica James, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe anybody else was even looking at expressionism at that time. But Toby produces this work, the Emperor, which Vincent really liked. But Vincent actually passed before he collected that work. And then Marina. Or was it Saskia? It was Marina. Marina collected the work. And she particularly liked the work because she knew also that Vincent liked the work. And she liked the fact that Toby had gone through this struggle with this work. It's many, many layers of shellacs and varnishes that he's experimenting with to develop the texture that he's developed. And he called it the Emperor. And the story goes, and Marina, correct me if I'm wrong, but the story goes that you said to him, Vincent was my emperor. So we have to have this painting in the collection. And so, you know, I could see, but Vincent's passed the eye on to Marina. But it's important to see how the separation, standing on the cusp between the older guys and this younger generation, was Antonius. Antonius likes to believe he's still in the younger generation, but I have to tell him, you know, I have news for you, my brother. Antonius's influence on Vincent was also extremely strong. Vincent began to rely on Antonius's thinking and his vision, and the way he saw the art, and Antonius is right around the corner here. Vincent's office was in the building next door, and he would go around the corner to the Bohemian Art Gallery. The Bag, as we called it, was right around the corner there. Antonius was there regularly, and they would talk about the work. And Antonius at the time had taken over at the College of the Bahamas. Stan had gone on to do what he was doing in the studio, and Antonius had taken over to influence another generation of young Bohemians. And I think between Antonius and of course Stan and Dennis Knight, Sue Bennett Williams, and you know, a few other of the teachers who were at the College of Bahamas, they've caused there to be at this point this flourishing of Bohemian art. But nobody had more influence in my mind on this explosion that we see taking place today than Vincent D'Aguilar. Vincent's influence is powerful because I don't even know if he was so conscious of what he did. I think he functioned very much like an intuitive himself, that he saw that there were works that spoke to him. And he had this kind of almost like the monk contemplation to go, and he would stand in front of a work and he would almost talk to that work, and then he would talk to the artist, and he wanted to know what was the thinking. And as I said to you, if he found out that you did not want to sell that work, he would find a way to get that work. In this collection are two pieces of my work that Pam, my wife, absolutely refused to sell. Absolutely refused to sell. But Vincent knew that Pam was away at a time when he started. It's a true story. I mean, when construction things was tough, and he came to the house. And just looking around, and I'm painting away. I used to paint in the living room, and it was this work around the space. And he says, what about mother? So I say, Pam, Vincent, you know Pam ain't gonna sell that, you know? So but he said, well, I mean, come on, man. How much you want for it? So anyhow, yeah, he made an offer that I couldn't refuse, and I said to him, you gotta get it out of the house before I found this box. And he had his cord and his rope with him. This is a piece 4 foot by 4 foot. And it's framed, and he takes the whole thing, including the frame, and he puts it on top of his car, gets his checkbook out, writes a check. And when Pam came home, I had to deal with that. but that's the way he functioned. The Watchman's Blues at the back, which is a painting that I did exactly, I don't remember, there's a date on it probably.
83,
yeah. See, that's, I had black hair and an afro, Vincent actually bought that when it was wet. I was still working. I said, Vincent, it's not ready. He said, but I like it. I see where you're going. And he would come and he would have that kind of relationship, not only with me, he would have that relationship with so many of the artists. He would stop them and he would talk to them. This collection of works, this is a part of a collection that John Beadle did. And he knew that John Beadle was going to be an important part of this whole vocabulary of Bohemian identity and expression that we are beginning to see emerge. And John had done about 80 of these faces for his thesis at Tyler School of Art, at Temple University. And Vincent just had to have, he had to have the ones. He would paint one that remotely looks like John, because I think most of these have, you know, John is painting from either from his gut or from looking in the mirror. So there was a sense of John. In those days, he had young buds before his dreadlocks really grew out, and so he would take a piece of that, but then he would also take something that was far less representational, and he wanted to have. He just decided, well, you know, I just want to have the a diverse look into John's head, and the self-portrait was important to him. He's collected several works of Stan's, and I know he would come to Stan's house. The Stan's work really forces you to think about, you know, what is it that he wants to say? I think he's, in a lot of ways, like a poet who works in color, painting, as he describes it, the landscape of his mind, you know, just painting imagery as well as texture and color that would provoke the viewer to think in very special terms about the work. You're not going to come to his work and find an answer. You're going to come to his work and you're going to find questions. And you got a question, well, what the hell was he trying to say, and what was he doing, and why did he do it? And if you take it seriously, you begin to discover for yourself the story that's in the work. And so a lot of what I'm saying now, it has come to me as I looked around this work. I'm particularly proud of the collection, of this particular collection, the collector's eye, Vincent's eye, this work represents. I'm particularly proud of the way the artists, the younger artists, particularly John Cox and Toby Lunn and Lillian Blades, Jason Bennett, the way they express themselves, because they are post 1973. John Cox was born in 73. All the others, I think, were born after 73. Toby Lunn?
72.
Oh, Toby, just under the wire. But still a part, you still represent a part of that period that they came along and they started to break through and dare to do some of the things that I believe we wanted to do as well. But we didn't feel the same kind of confidence. And I don't mean necessarily that we lacked the courage to paint the way they did, but to feel that we had a supportive culture that would have embraced the work. Because you, the viewer, the collectors, the audience, as important to the development of the expression as the artist is. And the community that the artist works in is also very important to inspire the works of the artist. And you have to feel that level of confidence and that level of comfort in what you did. And I think that the work that's happening today is beginning now to move Bohemian art to a level that we can't really even anticipate where we're headed. I think what we're going to see in the next 10 years is a movement of Bohemian art that's going to cause the entire world to pay attention to the Bahamas. And I don't say that lightly. I remember early 1980s, I had to speak to a Rotary Club. And I actually said to them that by the year 2020, because that's what we say today. But I said to them, there's gonna come a time when more visitors are gonna come to the Bahamas for our art and our culture and our heritage and the numbers who come here for the sun, sand, and sea. And the fellas say, boy, you're smoking too much of that thing. You know, you gotta back off. You know, it'll never happen. People are always gonna come for the sun, sand, and sea. And I do believe people will always come for the sun, sand, and sea. But, sorry.
John, you just missed all the nice accolades that you had.
I can't say that twice. I think people will always come for the sun, sand, and sea, but they are beginning to come, as they will come 2 weeks from today, or is it 2 weeks from today? No, it's almost a week, just only a week. Transforming Spaces. In this space, there will be Antonius Roberts. A retrospective of Antonius Roberts that we are looking forward to. A lot of work that a lot of us forgot, because so many people believe that Antonius is a sculptor. You know, I don't think any of us is a one word. I think we're all creative people. And this creativity that is the fire of the Bohemian culture is expressing itself in so many different ways. Antonius will be in this space, and I think it's important to see the root of Antonius's work, because even in his early works from 20, 30 years ago, you see that the work in the hand of the sculptor in the way he drew with his paint, the people who he focused on. His work was very subjective in those days. It was definitely bohemian people in character, in their clothing, with all the entourage around them that identified them as being bohemian. When today, when you see his work, the appeal is less to the rationale and much more to the heart, as it is with so many of us. And that movement to the emotional is what is connecting us to the rest of the world. And somehow Vincent D'Angelo saw that. And he put this collection together. If it had not been for Vincent D'Angelo, we would not be flourishing the way we are. I say that without any fear of contradiction. But we also would not have had this collection here in the Bahamas. Now, there are a number of other collectors who have very significant collections, but none like this. A lot of the other collections are a lot safer. They didn't go for the stuff that people were screwing their face up and saying, what were they trying to say here? Because the artist sometimes didn't have enough understanding of what he was feeling, but had enough feeling to put it on the canvas or to make it in the creation that he was making and to show it in the way, present it to the public, and trust that somebody would see it. And it was usually Vincent D'Angelo who saw it. And so you have this very unusual collection of works that would have ended up someplace else in the world. Don't forget now, by the 1990s, many of us were showing all over the Americas, in Europe, in the UK, in South America, in Asia, in Africa. Bohemian art was being collected by persons coming in who had far more exposure to the movements that influenced us than the Bohemian market did. And they were buying the Bohemian art. And they were taking it out of here. You know, the famous collection of Amos Ferguson's that went to the Wadsworth Athenaeum. Major collection of works. Amos showed at the Smithsonian, and so did any number of us show at the Smithsonian and any number of galleries in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Massachusetts, etc. And so people were coming to the Bahamas and very quietly taking work away. And Vincent was one of the few persons who was able to stop works that might have been bought by others. Not that he was saying that others ought not to buy the work, but he recognized that if somebody was not collecting this work, 30 years from now, we wouldn't have it. I mean, think about it. There were artists like Max Taylor and Brent Malone and Stan and Eddie Minnis and Ralph Harris and Alton Lowe who were making their living painting. And they had to sell it to somebody. And Vincent became that person. So, you know, it is extremely, extremely important. And every time I walk in this room and I walk into this collection, I get goosebumps. Recognizing the value and the importance of the foundation that he laid, pun intended. You know, it's the base of any architecture is the foundation, and this foundation is extremely important to the future development. I'll just end by saying that this fall, there will be a major show in Iowa. I mean, I lived in America 10 years, never been to Iowa. Whoever would have thought of going to Iowa? You know, it is Middle America, classic Middle America, but they decided that at their major space in
Waterloo.
The Waterloo Art Center is going to have a major show of those artists who were in Artists of the Bahamas, and it's going to be an incredible show. That is a space that has 100,000 square feet of exhibition space, and they're giving us the space we want to have. Mm-hmm. And they're showing off the Bahamian art, and that art hopefully will travel from there to other spaces in America before it comes back. And just like Joseph Spence and Paul Mears and Boyd Williams and Sidney Poitier later on, who went to the States and made their impact, Bohemian art is doing the same thing in a very powerful way. And a lot of the credit goes to Vincent. So I'm going to end on that note and open up the floor for us to have a conversation about whether I was right or wrong.
Marina has rolled up all these years. Sorry? Marina has rolled up all these years. It must have been quite supportive as a wife to see her husband acquiring at this enormous rate.
Marina's role?
Yeah.
She's right here, by the way.
Are you married? Okay, happily.
Happily divorced.
Happily divorced. But you know how a woman brings the dresses into the house when she wears the dress and she says, you say, that's a new dress? She says, oh no, that's been in the closet for years. How could you forget? Well, Vincent used to do the same with the paintings.
Yes, right? There you go. I love that stuff.
And in fact, he'd hide some of his paintings in my house in a daytime.
Yeah, well, you know, imagine, no matter how big his house was, imagine 800 pieces of wood trying to find a place. You know? Trying to find a place to put it.
You so beautifully described the explosion when Greg Malone exploded with John Canoe. Never could forget it. How soon after that did Vincent acquire those John Canoe paintings or any of them?
The one particularly, the history of John Canoe, has the African map in the middle of it, was originally collected from a Brent Malone show by Ortland Bodie. Yeah.
Senior Junior.
Ortland Bodie Junior. Ortland Bodie Junior had that painting because it was the most expensive piece in the show at the time. Ortland ended up with that painting. And when he bought it off the floor, or he got it later, I'm not exactly sure. But I know he had it, and Vincent got it from him because at some point, Ortland Bodie needed money. And he went to Vincent and he says, I got this painting. And Vincent said, yeah, I always wanted that painting. I always wanted that painting too. You know, and I sold it to a whole lot of other people, but it cost money.
It's in the office.
And it's a fabulous piece. 1976 was the first time, and I know because Pam and I collected the painting. It was the first time Brent was ever able to sell a painting for $1,000. And there was so much talk in that show about Martinique Gallery.
Yeah.
That they say, well, you know, Brent must be going crazy. $1,000, can you imagine what you would pay for a Brent balloon today?
Mm-hmm.
So $1,000, and they say, well, how do you expect to get $1,000? I mean, you got kids coming out of the college, how much are you asking $1,000 these days? That was 1976. Brent really started, and I think the first show, and I could be wrong, was 1982, around there. It was the first time he showed the junk in the work. He started out, there was a guy, Eddie Robinson, I think he was, at the, what's the name of the?
Bonneville
Bones.
Yeah.
He, in those days, young and slim and trim, and he posed for those classic pastels of Brent's with the bell, with the bell, the cowbell. And
Don has that, I think. That was here during the Brent Malone exhibit, during the Artists of the Bahamas show.
Don has that?
Yeah, and yeah. It was hanging here, okay, during the Brent show.
Well, that I believe was Brent's first, mm-hmm, was the first of that junk in the series. And then I ought to know, because I was in the Saxons, and he painted, the first painting he did was a Body Boy piece, which really pissed me off. You know that? I said, man, if you're going to be influenced by John Canoe, man, why don't you look at the real stuff? but he really, really had a good time and a good run. And then of course Brent went to Bali, and he kind of moved away from a lot of the heavy African influence works and became more influenced by the Asian work, and much more than he had before. But Vincent was paying attention to all these movements and all these changes, and he would find the artist's studio. And he would come to your studio, and he'd sit down. If you're sitting on crates, he's sitting on crates. You know, if you're standing up, he's standing up. But he wants to know, you know, why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you using color the way you're doing? Why are you putting the texture on the way you're doing it? Who's influencing you? Whose work are you looking at? What's happening in America? He would come to stand, and he would see magazines. I think Art in America was sitting on in Stan's studio one day, and he walked in there and he saw that. And next thing you know, he had a subscription to Art in America. And he was paying attention to the movements that was influencing the Bahamas. So as I said, you know, from the mid 1980s to the 2006, 2007, he amassed this huge collection, and then of course he and Marina traveling the world, he started to see the connections. He went to Africa and he started to see the connections with the sculpture in Africa and the work that was happening here. He went to Haiti, he paid attention, and he knew who the artists were. He didn't just have a kind of passing interest. Vincent became a scholar. You know, he really spent his eating, sleeping, drinking time in the books, trying to understand. I would love to have his collection of books. I'm putting my word in right now. No, but seriously, an incredible collection, of information that influenced him. And he didn't just have it, as so many of us do, including me, to decorate, you know. But he would read it, and he could come to you, and he could talk about the detail. He was intimate with the work. I think that's the right word. You know, he got intimate with the work.
Jackson, sweetheart.
Sweetheart, yeah, exactly. mean, that's, yeah. Think about that. Think about that. I mean, that if Marina was to be jealous, it was because of the work. Any other
Jackson
thoughts?
One thought you touch on, and you mentioned the aimless works, and I think a lot of artists, and a lot of artists, be it painting or anything in the Bahamas, have this, that you're not recognized at home. You tend to be accredited somewhere else, and then you know, you touch on the Forbes magazine and Amos Ferguson.
Yeah.
And I remember for Amos Ferguson, which brought him big, me for our Ministry of Tourism, was the American Express use of Amos Ferguson on the maps of the Bahamas.
Yes.
And suddenly, these artists became hot from, you know, suddenly the Haymans. So we start saying, well, we never took our own serious, but if American Express did, or Forbes magazine did, then we did. Did you see that? You touch on that transition. Was that a transition for Winston before he really got into his confidence? He said the Forbes magazine was the first. He came to you, you said, he came to you and he says, who's this Amos Ferguson? What is he all about? Why are people collecting him? And people were saying, my kids could do this.
Yeah.
What gave him the confidence?
Well, I think Vincent's appreciation was not superficial at all. He went deeper than that. He started to find out. He wanted to know why places like Wadsworth Avenue would collect his work. Why other persons were collecting his work? Who were other intuitives? You know, he wasn't the only intuitive in the Caribbean. People like Capo in Jamaica, who was perhaps even more famous than
Huey.
Than Amos. But Huey also, you know, many other persons who were important, and he started to see the connection with Amos Ferguson and these other persons. Our persons in America too. I mean, you know.
But my point was that if Forbes hadn't collected or American Express hadn't used it, you think it would have convinced it?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. Okay. Sure. No, I don't think American Express had anything to do. I don't think.
Okay.
Had anything to do with his influence.
Yeah.
Well, certainly, you know, when great corporate.
It's a certain cachet, you know.
Oh, and great corporate collections. I mean, Vincent was a businessman.
Yeah. Okay.
After all. You know, and he understood value,
okay.
And he understood real estate.
Okay.
And he was sharp. He knew this was positioning real estate. I mean, we did the superwash buildings for him, and superwashes don't happen on corners that aren't busy. You know, it costs money to buy a location that's active. You know, and that the same is true in art. Art is like good real estate. And he understood that value, and he saw that very, very clearly. But he also understood that it wasn't only measured by money. That the measurement was also something much, much deeper than the dollars and cents. Marina?
No, I just wanted to say to Tony that the very first Amos Ferguson and Vincent Boyd was an exhibition many years ago down at Life of Key, and they were showing him for the first time. Mm-hmm. And we were at the exhibition. At that time, we were only collecting bird prints, you know, Audubon and things like that. And so we went to this exhibition, and there was this painting of birds. Since we were collecting birds, we figured, oh, this is pretty. Let's buy it. And he said, well, I like it. But it's $300. And at the same time, we were deciding if we spent $300 on Amos. Mel Doty, I guess we all know him, he was the decorator.
Uh-huh.
He decorated and so forth. He came up behind Vincent and said, surely, Vincent, you're not buying this. This is child's work. But Vincent turned around and said to him, but I like it. Which was one of the reasons why he collected art. He liked what he was buying.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we bought it for $300 and didn't buy any food.
Just
I still have that painting. Is it still in the Vincent Rowe?
Do you remember what year that was? Sorry.
This one's 73, I think.
1973?
Yeah, I have the price list.
You know what I mean? When you bought it.
I have the original price list from the show. When I showed it to Karen and Tom.
But Justin, I think the reason for that is that a lot of young artists would say to you, and you talk about this, Toby, just really being able to let go and being brave enough to do it. And it takes a lot of courage and a lot of risk.
Right.
And I think a lot of artists here today will tell you they get into this niche and they say, I want to go this way, but no one is going to take it. No one is going to accept it.
Mm.
And I'm sure a lot of...
A lot of us end up doing what was safe. You know, there was a movement that Vincent was very much, it was kind of like the silent partner, if you like, in the Because movement, which was started by Stan and included Antonius and myself. But also Brent and Max and James Smith and John Beadle. It was Bohemian creative artists for serious expression. And we had several shows and the idea was that we wanted to break through the picture postcard of that we were saying. Not that there was anything wrong with the picture postcard, but it was more to us than the ocean, the palm trees, and the commercially successful and demanding work. I mean, and there are a number of people, like John Paul's here, who's a master at that work. And I tip my hat to anybody who has the ability to do that again and again and again. But there was a need that we felt to go beyond that. And so we got together and we had several shows. And that was a very important time. And Vincent was the person, in a lot of ways, who supported what we were doing because he would come. He supported it not only with his money, but he supported us with his encouragement, which was equally as important and valuable to all of us as we were working. I think artists are much more influenced by the level of genuine support and encouragement that they can get from whoever the audience is. And Vincent certainly knew how to do that. And as he became more and more aware of what art was doing and the power that art had to begin to influence the way we think as a community, he invested more. I mean, don't forget now, you know, in 1973, most Bohemians still said we have no culture.
Yeah.
And most Bohemians, even today, some of us still believe that. Well, quite a few Bohemians say Junkanoo is our culture, or the regatta is our culture, or crack conk is our culture, and misunderstand that all these things are expressions and the importance of the culture goes beyond that. Vincent understood How important the culture was, and how important innovation and creativity, when crossed with industry, would be to the future of our Bahamas. And I believe we're beginning to see that. We're having quite a few conversations. We have a meeting that goes on Fridays, Creative Nassau, which is a group that came together to apply to UNESCO for Nassau to become a city of design in the UNESCO Creative Cities Network. We've been at it for 2.5 years. I won't go into details, but we meet every Friday. And one of the conversations that we're having now as we're completing the second application that we've sent to UNESCO. It takes us a year to prepare one of these applications. We were rejected the first time, but we've gone at it again. last May or whatever it was, he got a letter saying, "We love what you are saying, but you ain't good enough yet. You ain't get it right. You ain't, you know, da 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 da." And they gave us some criteria, which we understood. We swallowed that and we've gone at it again. And one of the conversations that we've been having is you know, design of industry and design of the workplace, the design of service in the industries that are so important to us. You say we're in a service industry, but we haven't designed a service that grows out of a culture that is ours, that there isn't sufficient understanding of what makes us who we are, enough to be able to get the best out of it. Now, Grammy and Grandpa didn't have that problem. They just welcomed folks in, and things were simple enough. They were reinforced because the community was small enough, and there was much more conversation. There was no motor car. You walked to church, you walked to school, you walked to the meat man, you walked to the shoemaker, and you got to know everybody. You knew everybody in the community. There was no television. Oh, what do we do without the television? There was no television. And so we had this very powerful impact that made it very clear to us. And even though we weren't always conscious of what we were doing, it was very clearly behaving. And we knew how to welcome people. And we knew how to be hospitable. And we had this reputation for being the most hospitable people. They, you know, we just wonderful. And now we learn from Detroit and New York and California and Gaddafi, the Barefoot Bandit. You know, we learn from all these influences that come from outside. And so it's necessary for the designer now to have a place in all of this. And the artist represents, I believe the artist represents the arrowhead of the design movement. That design for change in this new Bahamas that we have to create. I mean, I don't want to get into politics, but I'll just simply say that, you know, while we argue about who can get the money from cable and wireless, there's homicide and there's suicide and there's matricide and there's patricide and there's fratricide, and, you know. Infanticide and on and on and on. And all we're going to have left is the bones to argue with when it's all said and done, unless the artists begin to show that there's hope, that there's something that we could, you know, we could see ourselves, we could look in the mirror. John Kunuman could look in the mirror and say, "Man, that's me. You know, I see me and I'm proud." And feel that pride in a society which before that was saying he's the old John Kunu. Carry your so and so and so. That the artist celebration of the John Kunu made a difference. And you know, in the modern non-representational work, the person who looks at that work, it could feel, that's my feelings. When I look at a John Cox and I look at Jason Bennett and I look at Toby Lunn and, you know, what Antonius is doing. Antonius, can you share what you're doing with the schools? Can you share that yet?
No, you please go ahead.
Antonius, you think I'll make the story up and it'll make it more elaborate?
Yeah, you're a better storyteller than I am.
No, I was very impressed the other day. Antonius is telling me that he's going to the schools and taking the design of those lovely benches, several of them outside in the garden, and taking them to the schools and introducing the young people to the schools, in the schools, to the benches, giving them the design of the benches, planning the pattern. Thank you. And causing them to make them, and causing them to realize what happens to a space when you have that kind of intervention, when you have such a loving care, you make something and it's beautiful, and you place it in a space, it changes not only the space, but it changes the people who interact with that space. And that's what design does in a very special kind of way.
And in fact, if you can use your own hands, you tend to appreciate it.
That's right.
And understand it.
And build it yourself.
And build it yourself.
Yes.
In fact, that same pattern is in Eleuthera. They're using that pattern right now to make the purchase for that new...
For the National Trust.
The National Trust, yeah.
Libby,
yeah, I saw a pattern over there as well.
Yeah, if you get to Eleuthera, that's a new park that is opening tomorrow. National Trust celebration, the Libby. Yeah.
I'd like to make a comment about risk-taking. That is that you mentioned us young artists taking risks, and it's because of you guys, you know? I just wanted to express my gratitude, I think, because I didn't really get introduced to the art sort of world until I went to COB, when Stan Burnside introduced it to me. So I just wanted to say I'm grateful for you, Jackson, and Stan, and what Antonius is doing, a lot of the sort of the what I would call the giants in the Bahamian art world who have really sort of like opened up a path. It's not an easy path. Everyone will tell you that it's still a struggle. But I just wanted to acknowledge how much we appreciate that, and that allows us to take that kind of risk.
Thank you, Toby. I don't blush for
anything. But Toby, may I also say something, Jackson? It is really interesting because I remember Vincent D'Aguilar, I think he bought his... the first time he spent the money with me was in the 90s. We were close. He would come to the exhibition, exactly what Jackson said, he would look. There's one painting that's going to be in the show coming up. It's called Wash Day.
Remember that?
You remember that painting?
I remember it very well.
All right. That painting actually... That had Vincent D'Aguilar's name on it. Because that painting was done right across from Vincent's first superwash on Nassau Street. Right across there were some little houses, and there were some people sitting there at the tub washing. And at the time with the Bahamian Art Gallery, we had to raise money to keep this gallery open. We tried to set Vincent up. We said, how would we get this man's money? And so, Tony, you got to paint a painting that Vincent would like. And I painted this painting. I spent time painting this painting. Vincent walked in there, and he walked all around. And I said, you know, everything you should buy that? He said, well, tell me why I should buy that. He said, because it's right across from that. He said, and so why should I have it? And then he looked at me and said, why should I buy from you when Max Taylor is doing similar stuff, and Max has greater reputation? Why should I spend my money with you as opposed to Max? And I will tell you, that changed my entire life. That's when I started to splash. Because Vincent said to me that you need to be a little bit more creative. I've seen it, but he pushed me. And what was so interesting, Toby, about taking risks, when I decided to move from the wash day, thank goodness, I had a very good friend, brother, Mr. Campbell Clare, who took pity on me and bought that painting. He came right behind me and said, that's all right, I'll buy it. It's the Campbell's collection today, right?
But I don't think he took pity on you. I think he recognized the value of a good investment.
But it's interesting. But you know, when I moved from that, I lost the Campbell Clare. Campbell stopped buying my work. What a foolish decision as you do it, man. It's a true story, right? But you know, what was so interesting is we left the safe, but there was a Vincent D'Aguilar.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So taking risks, is very important.
No, absolutely. No, your early waking would say, oh, what about Antonius? You know, and he really, his head really came off and really, 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 really loved your sculpture. Yeah. And you started to get into anyone who knows Antonius's work, not that he's not a good painter, but I think he found his voice and his soul in the wood, as you see all over, literally all over the world today. And Antonius is on the arrowhead, and you know, Bahamian artists now have more nerve to do the things that they didn't do before. I always tell the story about Ellison Thompson, who was the father-in-law of Eddie Minnis, and Eddie came home from Montreal with his wife Sherry, and I was walking through Glynn Square, and Mr. Thompson, it was Mr. Thompson then, is my wife's family, so eventually I started to call him Uncle Ellison. But I mean, the truth of the matter was he was big, harsh voice kind of fellow. He'd say, "What's that? Come here." Right? And I'm wondering what I did wrong, because as a little boy going through this in Agnes Church, you know, he was one of those fiery characters. So he calls me and he says, "Why don't you talk to your friend?" And I say, "Who? And what you talking about?" Talk to Eddie. You see, he around here, and this, he had a big Volkswagen, love van, you know, what do you call those big wagons? And he said, "Talk to him, man. Tell him get a real job." Around here, Peyton, how are you going to take care of my daughter? I mean, literally, he realized that Eddie would, Eddie's work would eventually go for thousands and thousands. I mean, if he was to come back today and see the sticker on an Eddie Minnis painting, I think he would go right back. He would serious coronary. At that point, Eddie was selling his works. He's still working in ballpoint pen and felt pens. And he would sell the work. If he got $100, he was happy. Those were the days, 1960s, late 1960s. Eddie came back in 1969. It was a tough time. But any number of artists like him and Max and Kendall and Brent, they had the nerve. And they stuck it out. Amos Ferguson, they stuck it out. And they built the shoulders on which the younger Bohemian artists are standing. And it's important that this collection is here, because this collection tells the history. Because, you know, I have to come in a space like this to get my memory back. You know, it kind of rejuvenates the stories of this evolution that is taking place in Bohemian art. And it's extremely, extremely important. And so Bohemian art today is flourishing as a result. Any other dialogue? Any other?
I just wanted to ask you about some of the influences. Jackson, you talked about the African influence, the biblical influence, the common working man influence. What are the other influences that you've seen in the past and that you see in the current work?
Well, like I said before, I believe that before there was the artists, a generation of artists represented by those who were born in the 70s. It was important to us to have identifiable imagery that connected us to what we call Bohemian culture. You know, I had to look a certain way. I mean, even Brent Malone, you know, my mother was surprised, because she knew the family way back when, in the 1930s. There's a white Bohemian family, and here's a son of the white Bohemian family in these black folks. I mean, it was important to us because it was a representation. Because, that's what Europe was doing. That's where Europe had gone. The whole modern movement was paying attention to those African influences, which were extremely, extremely important. Ralph Harris, I mean, Alton Lowe painted the Bunce in Abaco, but who knows what the Bunce is? Anybody?
Mm-hmm. Painted the what?
Bunce.
The Bunce. No? Yeah, yeah, yeah. John Kulu in New Plymouth, which were primarily white Bahamians who were producing the jungle. And he painted that scenery, but with exception, there were a few exceptions of artists who stepped outside of painting the subjective, the images of ourselves, and white and black. But it was usually the more stylized and more romanticized images of the fisherman, the farmer, the junkanoo, the surrey driver, the police officer, those kinds of images that influence us. And you know, along comes John Cox. Let me pick on him. even his mom didn't know what the hell he was doing. Am I right or wrong? I say, boy, I really like what John is doing. Because I'm trying to get in to understand, I'm trying to feel out his experimentation. And, you know, here is this man looking on the other side of the world. He's not in Abaco or Exuma looking for his influences. He's in Japan. And he is painting not only the, I think, very heavily influenced by the graphics of the woodcuts as a printmaker. And you can speak on this, but this is how I'm seeing it. and he's heavily influenced by the woodcuts and the expressions of that side of the world. Someone's got to write this, you know, and document it in such a way so that it could be shared with another generation 30 years from now. This is, I think, an important story. Because what John Cox is doing in Pop-Up, and I want to celebrate it, is just extremely important and very powerful movement. You've got what's happening with Pop-Up and a number of other galleries, and then you have the National Art Gallery, which was that pivotal point. It had to be. I mean, it's a pivotal point that pushed us beyond, because that was the first political statement in this country that said Bahamian art was important. I still don't think it's ever enough, but it was significant, it was powerful. Tony Jarvis restored the old building, and it went from there. And of course, we didn't have a collection. We had somewhat of a collection. The central bank had a bit of a collection. We had what we might have called the national collection that we used to keep down in Jumbe Village. But it wasn't treated the way this collection is treated and celebrated. It wasn't treated the way the central bank's collection is being treated. And so the National Art Gallery had to reach out and find the works to show off. And I think, you know, and I want to celebrate them too, because I think they're doing a great job in causing us to recognize that we have something that is extremely important. So, you know, when you look at all the connections, I like to really believe that the sum is greater. How does it go?
Than all the parts.
Than all the parts? Somebody help me with this. Now I understand why the Baptist preacher says, somebody help me.
Seriously, would you have to say Vincent was literally the first chairman, co-chairman?
I thought you were going to say he was the first bishop.
Who started the art gallery?
He was the first chairman, and he was really driving for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And you know, credit, I'll give credit to Hubert Ingraham. That has nothing to do with politics. But I wear, say I wear a blue shirt now, I wear a yellow shirt or red shirt. but it was important that he understood that, and he says, you know, I'm going to buy that building, let's do something.
I hope the memory is not wrong. Vincent gave one of the first tours, and wasn't it his favorite paintings in at the National Gallery, in a side gallery, and
yes.
He... Anybody else was there?
Yes,
there was a show of his collection. Yeah. What was the name of that show?
One Man's Vision.
Is it
on tape? So
it's not on tape, but we have the transcript.
But there's a book, there's a catalog.
Was it?
Okay, that was fabulous. His personal.
Yeah, and he did a lot. He wrote a lot too. So, I have the privilege of seeing that. Saskia, can I share these?
Yes, that's why I put them there for you.
Oh,
they're all the. Well, they're all on the wall.
If you can take one.
This is the.
If you didn't get one before, I mean, this is the course. Sorry.
You know, when Jackson curated the show, he also perused all of Vincent's writings and reflections on his work. Vincent was a scholar, and he did. Write and reflect and had kind of a journal about his recollections. And Jackson actually had the courage to try to decipher it. His handwriting isn't easy to read, but once you start reading it, then you kind of get the gist of it. And a lot of the Vincent's writings, some of the more relevant quotes, are on the walls. And when we had the opening, people did say to me afterwards, what was that stuff on the walls that I couldn't read? So retranslated it and put it into this little paper. And so the same thing that's on the various quotes and Vincent's handwriting on the walls is on the sheet, and you can see how Vincent reflects on his work and his sweethearts.
Yes, that's right. Any other comments, thoughts, questions?
Jackson, thank you so much.
Fantastic.
And I want to say thank you to all of you for coming out, making this special. Thanks to Saskia and Marina and Dane from the AGDA Art Foundation. We'll do it again in another few years. Well, somebody else will do it the next. 800 words.